Hi, this is Eric Schlein of the Intelligent Investing Podcast. Today's episode of the Intelligent Investing Podcast is sponsored by Red Rock Running. Runners and joggers out there, tell me if this sounds familiar. You go into your local running store to pick up some gear, first the shirt, and as you browse the shirts, you see that nice, high-quality performance shirt running you at least $40. Then, you need something to carry your smartphone so you can listen to the Intelligent Investing Podcast while you run. Or maybe you want to track your run with a GPS. A smartphone carrier costs something like $20 or $30. And between work, family, and other responsibilities, the only chance many of us have to go for a run is early in the morning or late at night. That often means running in the dark. So, to help stay safe, you need a reflective vest to increase visibility. That's another $10, $15. So, in total, you can expect to spend over $100 just for gear that goes on your upper body. Red Rock Running has a better way. Their new Bryce running shirt combines all three of those products into one simple item. Secure pockets built directly into each sleeve carry your smartphone or other audio device, a couple of keys, headphones, or energy gels. Strategically placed, reflective material increases your visibility, keeping you safe when running in the dark. Intelligent Investing Podcast listeners know the importance of value. Purchasing a technical shirt, smartphone carrier, and a reflective vest separately costs over $100. The Bryce running shirt, however, gives you all three for only $59. And Red Rock Running is offering listeners this podcast an additional 15% off any purchase by using the promo code INVESTINGPOD at checkout. So that's right, listeners, if you are a listener of the Intelligent Investing Podcast, you get an additional 15% off any purchase of a shirt that's already a good value by using that promo code INVESTINGPOD at checkout. So remember, go to Red Rock Running, REDROCK, running.com, and receive 15% off your Bryce running shirt with promo code INVESTINGPOD, INVESTINGPOD. Carry more, increase visibility, decrease hassle.
Welcome to the Intelligent Investing Podcast, where modern portfolio theory can suck it. A student of the school of Graham and Doddsville and a clergy member of the Church of Warren Buffett, here's your host, Eric Schlein.
Hi, this is Eric Schlein, and welcome to the Intelligent Investing Podcast. Today we have a great show for you. We have Gopinath Balasubramanian, is that correct?
That's correct.
Correct, awesome. With GB Investments, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Eric.
Can I just call you Gobi? Is that cool?
Gobi's perfect,
all right,
yeah.
Perfect. So welcome on the show. Tell us a little bit about who you are and what you do.
Yeah, as you said, my name is Gopinath Balasubramanian.
You said it better than I did, by the way.
I think people can go with Gobi, which is much easier. I do run a small investment management advisory firm. It's called GB Investments. Let me give you a little background about me, I trained as a software engineer. I finished my engineering in India,
okay.
And then I took a job in software development at a company called Infosys Technologies. They're one of the biggest Indian software consulting firms. Right. And I worked through multiple clients like America Online, Netscape, and then I moved to a different company called Towers Watson. It's recently been acquired or merged with Willis Towers. During those years, I developed a bug for investments, and here we are.
What had you get in? What gave you the bug for investments? I'm always curious people's story and how they get into it.
It was interesting, actually. I did not know anything about investments until, I came to U.S. 10 years ago. And I had this job. I was working at this AOL. And, I had surplus money. You make money and you spend some of it, and then the remaining becomes a savings. And I needed to figure out, what am I going to do with the money? And it wasn't easy to figure out, what to do. And luckily, though, I came across, business as an interesting topic because, I always thought that, business, I never know what the business are. But all of them seemed, fun, and they were all rich. But I didn't think that I had any skill in running a business. So I started, reading about, in general, like, you know, about the business, like how to write the business plan and so on and so forth. And then I came across this book about Warren Buffett. Even at that time, I thought, like, who names the guy Buffett, right? With the two T's, though.
Yeah.
And then it sounded very simple that you don't have to be a business owner to be an operator. You can just be a passive investor. Somebody else run the business for you. I thought that was very fascinating when I first find out. And then, you know, the whole learning curve, like, you know, kicks in. But, like, you know, how you can be an investor or a shareholder and you let somebody else to run the tough jobs like running the business.
Right. And how long ago was it when you was Warren Buffett that got you hooked? Was that?
Yeah, that was fascinating because nobody ever, like, you know, tells it is and then run the life the same way he did.
Yeah.
So it was very interesting that, like, it just, like, resonated with me immediately. And then, like, you know, you go through the biographies of, like, you know, Mary Buffett, like, you know, Roger Lowenstein, and then you go through all of that, and then either you get it or you don't.
Right.
Fortunately, in my case, I thought I got some of it, and then I went along with it.
And how many years ago was that?
I would say about 11 years now.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then did you start investing right away?
Yeah, I mean, the only way to, you know, learn something really new is, you know, just do it.
Yeah.
Because I would say the difference between, like, reading a romantic novel and really dating somebody is completely different.
What? What? Really?
Oh, I man. Think so.
Yeah,
don't you think so?
Yes, I absolutely think so. Yeah. Being sarcastic. interesting. So, tell me a little bit about the company you run. So you're obviously a value investor. You know, are you kind of just run-of-the-mill value investor, kind of doing what other value guys do, or do you specialize in anything? Is there something that makes you a little bit different?
No. Like, you know, in general philosophy, like value investments, I go wherever the opportunity is.
Okay.
Like, you know, some people specialize on, like, one versus another.
Right.
I think, like, you know, you cannot be in one particular area and hoping that you can find, like, some opportunities all the time over there. So I pretty much go wherever the opportunity is, irrespective of, like, you know, the businesses being great business or okay business or, you know, different types of industries, different types of, like, you know, even countries.
Yeah. Do you invest in India at all?
I do.
Interesting. Now, I'm assuming you're from India?
Yeah.
You don't just put on the accent?
No.
Where,
I wish I could.
where in India are you from?
I'm from South India. I grew up in a place called Chennai.
Okay.
It's a province, Tamil Nadu.
Okay.
It's a southern tip, pretty close to Sri Lanka.
So do you feel being from India, you have some advantage in terms of understanding the market out there? But
It's hard to say, but people usually assume that, like, you know, if you're from some area, you understand some of it.
Right.
It's true in some sense that, like, you know, like, you know, what kind of people you grew up with, and I still have, like, 95% of my family in India. So I go back to India, like, you know, still at least once a year.
Mm-hmm.
So you still get the, like, the gist of, like, you know, what the consumers are and what kind of people you're dealing with in business and all of that. But it's a huge difference to think that, you know, if you're from India, you probably have an edge or something like that.
Right. Is there, I would imagine there is, but is there a cultural difference between the way, say, corporate America generally is run versus the corporate world in India? Are there any, like, major differences that you notice?
The one major difference is, like, usually, I would say, like, 75 or maybe, like, even 80% of the companies are still probably run by the founder family.
Okay.
And they probably control, like, more than, like, let's say 50% of the stock.
Mm-hmm.
So as an investor, a passive investor, small investor, you really don't have any say in how the business should be run.
Now, do you see that generally as a disadvantage or an advantage, or it doesn't really matter?
I don't think it matters. Like, let's say, like, you know, here, like, you know, let's say 20% of the company, even 5% of the company is, like, run by, like, a founding family with,
yeah,
control, right? As an investor, you don't have any say in anything anyway.
Interesting.
Like whether the company is controlled here in US or not, the same way I see it too. But again, you know, some people are better than others. So you need to do a due diligence to figure out who do you want to partner with.
Yeah. And is there
but
any...
it's not a black and white. It's not a black and white on anything.
Right. Do you think there's more governmental risk as well investing on India?
Like define government. Like what does it mean by government risk?
In terms of any kind of corruption or regulatory risks, anything like that. I'm not really familiar with Indian markets at all. So,
I mean that's always there, right? Like we don't know what we don't know.
Right.
But you should know that India is a developing country, and things are pretty corrupt. Like in terms of politics, in terms of businesses, and so on and so forth. Yeah, but you do have to assume that there is a level of corruption that you need to be okay with if you're going to be investing in India.
Yeah. Are you finding interesting opportunities out there right now?
Yeah. Like India is a peculiar place. Like a lot of people invest in India and in really, really big companies.
Mm-hmm.
And that remains, because that's the big pool and you can participate in that. And the small companies are really, really small to even, put any type of money to work without, changing the investment landscape there. So in a little bit smaller areas, you see plenty of companies, under, I would say, even, $200 million market caps.
Yeah.
Indian companies are, amazing. Some companies are.
And then how do you search for those? How do you find those companies?
There is no structured search. I used to do screeners before.
Yeah.
But they won't tell the true story. You go through 200 companies from the screener, and then you figure out you're wasting your time.
Right.
And right now, yeah, since I've been in this for almost 10 years now, doing diligently, I hope. And you come across situations somebody. How they run the company, what kind of products and service that they're selling.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them are appealing to you. Some of the businessman's nature is appealing to you. In most cases, the price is appealing to me.
So what is your, I'm very curious about your process in terms of actually finding out about companies in India. Are you just randomly looking through company reports? Do you just go on the Indian Stock Exchange and manually click on different companies? What's your process for that?
Okay, so let me give you an example, recent example, without naming the name of the company,
sure.
Right? I would have never thought, I would be doing something here, right? So I have this, in Google Alerts, I set up this something called buyback and tender offers, keyword searches. And then every day I get emails about, all over the world, who's buying what and so on and so forth. Usually for buybacks and tenders, right?
Okay, yeah.
So I come across this opportunity. This company says they're going to buy back 10% of the company. And usually when I look at that, and I look at generally what the price of the company is trading at. The moment you see it, it will give away some information. Either the company is really, really cheap, it gives you some indication. If the company is let's say all-time high in a few years, it also gives you some idea of the motivation behind the manager's buyback offer, right?
Yeah.
So I got this thing and I looked at the prices. It was all time high. And then I thought look at some misallocation of capital in the beginning, right?
Right.
And then I go look at the balance sheet of the company. Actually, the company had 50% of the market cap in cash, no debt.
Interesting.
But again, the interesting thing is why would they want to do now versus, let's say, a year ago, 2 years ago, the price was half of this.
Mm-hmm.
And but the offer indicated that why they want to do something like that now versus before. When I've read through the buyback tender offer contract, and it was interesting that the same guys who's running the buyback, they run a couple of different companies as well. So they all did buyback tender offers in the last year or so. So these companies are actually managed by one family, and they run a holding company. These guys are subsidiaries. That's the smaller companies who are doing the tender offers.
Interesting.
So interestingly, I ended up looking at the holding company because it was selling at one-third of the subsidiary's market value.
That's really, really fascinating.
The subsidiaries are not really expensive. Subsidiaries are like, you know, they're buying back like a 10 to 15% the last year.
Yeah.
They don't have a lot of debt, and they're about like, you know, 9 to 10 times PE.
Interesting.
So, but the accounting quirks, like, you know, makes the holding company looks like, you know, expensive than it is, because these companies, like, you know, more than 20% of the subsidiaries are owned by the holding company.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to mark the, you don't mark by market, you have to mark the assets by the cost.
Okay.
So the cost is like 1/10 of the value that they're holding. So if you look at the book value of the holding company, the price to book multiple looks like 3 times.
It looks high, yeah. Interesting.
But it's actually like, you know, 1/3 of the subsidiaries like marketable value today.
Huh.
But you need to make sure that the management that you're going with, they're reasonably like, you know, competent, and they're not going to screw you over.
So you've researched, I'm assuming you researched the management team and their history and.
Yeah. I went through like last month or so, like, and I went through like, you know, all the companies that they ran. They've been in the business for like since 1950 in one way or another. So they're talking about the right things, like, you know, where they want to invest their money, how they want to capitalize the business. Do they, like, you know, go into like leverage situation, buying another people, because these guys are always like, you know, with a lot of money.
Yeah.
So there's always opportunities comes to these guys saying like, you know, hey, do you want to get into any action? They said, no, we don't really. We want to do what we can for the shareholders because we are the biggest owner.
Yeah.
And yeah, we run a conservative company, and
I assume a good track record too.
They have a great track record, but you have to really dig in to see what they have done so far.
Interesting. So, and all you do is you set up, is it like you set a Google alert or?
Yeah. I have like a Google alert, set it up for like, you know, like multiple keywords, like, it could be buyback, it could be tender, it could be like, you know, like so many different things that you usually look for.
Mm-hmm.
So these alerts, like, you know, get to me like, you know, every day. Maybe I'll get like 10 different emails. And saying like sometimes the email has like, you know, 15 different like, you know, links in that, like, you know, different companies are doing different things. Sometimes they just send me like, you know, 1 or 2 links.
Interesting. So fascinating. Are you finding opportunity in the United States as well?
Not as cheap as in India, but
yeah.
But again, like, and if you look at the U.S. market as a whole, like, mm-hmm. when they talk about U.S. market, they're probably talking about S&P 500.
Right.
And like, other than that, there are plenty of other companies, like, you know, they're probably better than as a group, as S&P 500, and they probably run by like different managers, like better. In some cases, they're actually cheaper.
Yeah. Interesting. So what have been some of your most interesting investments that you've made in the past? And then also maybe some of your biggest mistakes and what you've learned from them as well.
Yeah, the mistakes are easy because there are plenty.
So let's start with those then.
Yeah. So, well, again, the beginning mistakes I don't count as a mistake because really, really tiny capital and I didn't have a lot of experience. But the mistakes that I'm going to talk is like basically the bigger ones,
yeah.
that I had money and I lost money in those deals. I should not have.
Yeah.
So there's a Russian company like in a couple of years ago. It's called CTC Media. You probably have heard about them.
Mm-hmm.
They're a broadcasting company, and they were pretty close to like $1 billion market cap at that time, and they had like 30% of market share in like in Russian TV broadcasting, and they had no debt, and they were making, let's say, like $150 million in free cash flow, and the management was like pretty much giving all the free cash flow to the shareholders. One of the biggest shareholders was like a Swedish conglomerate company. They owned about like more than 20% of the company. And the founders, like in two founders, they owned about like 20-25% of the company. So on paper, everything looks amazing. And it was selling for like less than 10 times of the free cash flow at that time when I bought it.
Yeah.
And then usually like you found out a lot of information later. And then 2 years ago, maybe 2014 or 2015 early, the Russia went into recession. All the Russian stocks like got hammered along with this CTC Media as well. So at that time, it was interesting. Nothing happened to any other companies or industries. A Russian government imposed a rule, a new law, that no foreign shareholder can own more than 20% of the Russian media companies.
Huh.
Yeah, the media companies got like stocks got like hammered like anything. It was just like went to hell pretty much.
Yep.
And like I had the stock before that. So pretty much like, you know, it just vanished like, you know, 70% of the value or so. It vanished. I probably bought the stock at like, you know, like $9 or so. It just went to like, you know, $2.
Then did you buy more at $2? Was it cheap? Did you think it was cheap at $2?
It was cheap, but you know that like, you know, the Russian government pretty much said like, you know, basically nobody other than Russians can own more than 20% of the company. And yeah. It was like pretty much like hassle. Like, you know, I don't, you know, nobody knows like what that means. And then maybe another 6 months or so, they said that, yeah, that's pretty much it. So I thought that the Swedish company conglomerate, they would restructure a deal somehow to like, you know, get away from the 20% ownership, or the founders would figure out a way and do something to the shareholders to retain some value. They pretty much did nothing. So basically they found another company, bigger company to sell this company at like, you know, $2.10 or something. And yeah, pretty much like, you know, you're gone.
Jeez. Well, that's Russia for you, right?
Yeah, like, you know, you hear a story about like, you know, Russian investments, and you know, you always think that, you know, this is not my turn.
Yeah.
My turn is not gonna be like that. But again, like, you know, this has just happened to be this particular industry. But if you had bought any Russian stocks during those times, you would have made like multiples of your money. I just happened to be in the, I don't know, like a wrong direction, I guess.
Well, that's, so you remember I was asking about governmental risk earlier. That would be an example of governmental risk.
Yeah, I wouldn't consider in India, like, you know, you would see something like this, like drastic of a change to like, you know, change the law pretty much.
Yeah, and if I recall, India's if anything is getting better in terms of the regulatory environment.
Yeah, India's like, you know, the legal system has always been like tough, especially with like individual rights are very, very much protected.
Okay.
You know, even compared to US, like, you know, you just cannot do anything against an individual if he has like, you know, legal claims on assets and so on and so forth.
Interesting.
But yeah, like, you know, I should not have been there in Russian investment in any way, but. Again, yeah, you have to learn something.
Any other interesting mistakes that are noteworthy?
Yeah, I have plenty. I'll probably share like, you know, one other with you.
Okay, sure.
This is an U.S. company. It's called Iconics Brands.
Okay.
They are a brand management company. They basically own like, you know, like multiple brands like Lee Cooper, or like, you know, like, you know, retail brands like Mikasa and like, Joe Boxster, like, you know, like underwear, like, you know, all kinds of brands. So the CEO who has like, you know, bought these brands, and then he pretty much like, you know, shipped it off to like, you know, retailers and other people on a royalty stream. So basically you buy a brand and you give like a Walmart exclusive right to like, you know, develop this particular brand, and we'll collect like, you know, 1.5% royalty on that. That's it.
Yep.
It's a great business. Because basically, like, you know, somebody else puts up the capital and operation, and you collect the royalty. But over the years, the founder manager, he basically like ramped up the debt to buy these brands because he sees the annuity type cash flow from these deals, and he ramped up like a lot of debt. And I actually owned this company like in 2011 when they had like almost no debt. Mm-hmm. And then the stock price went up like really high. I sold it, and then they issued like a lot of debt to buy back some of the stock, which should have been a mistake. Like in hindsight now, it looks very, very mistake.
Yeah.
But yeah, like, you know, and the brand royalty business got like a little bit tarnished on the way down. So the revenues are down, and some of the Chinese ventures that they made were not very much profitable. So pretty much like the revenue streams are coming down, and surprisingly the debt schedule, like, you know, came up.
Yeah.
Very quickly. So they were not able to pay back the debt immediately, so they arranged a kind of very much expensive, like, you know, debt schedule to borrow money at a very high rate to pay back the debt. And yeah, like, you know, debt became a problem, the equity, like, you know, goes to hell pretty much. So yeah, you can take a look at the company. It was trading at some point at, like, you know, $40 or so. And it's probably trading at, like, you know, $8 now. But I still hold it. And it's probably one of those cases, like, you know, the price comes down. The business has come down a little bit, but not all the way down. But relative to the price today, the business is still appears cheap, mm-hmm. given that management somehow handles the debt crisis, like, you know, somehow, like, it pushes it back or refinance it somehow.
Interesting. What would you say is the most interesting investment you've ever made, like, that ended up working out for you?
Well, yeah, given the mistakes that we made, right? Like, you know, yeah, I have at least, like, in a couple that I can. Let me show you, like, maybe one in, let's say, developed market, one in, let's say, in India.
Okay, sure.
I'll tell you the case in India. There's a company called Infinite Computer Solutions. They are a software consulting firm.
How did you discover this company, by the way?
Yeah, actually, I was visiting India. I had, like, a private investment in India. So I was in the process of maybe, like, figuring out, like, what to do with it, maybe sell it to somebody or something like that. So I went to India for, like, a few months to figure out. And one of my friends suggested that, like, hey, this company looks really cheap. You're into stocks, right? I was like, yeah, what the hell? This guy knows, right? So I looked at it, like, randomly. It was looking like something like 2x EBITDA and 3x earnings. This guy, like, you know, this guy was not genius. He occasional stock investor.
Yeah.
And he just gave this tip to me. I was like, okay, let me go take a look at this. Maybe, like, in 20 minutes, I'll figure out if it's worth even, like, in doing anything with it. And I looked at the financial statements and no debt. And the company had, like third of their market cap in cash. And the founder manager, who owned about 65% of the company was in public for, like, at that time, it was maybe about, like, 4 years. And before that, they were private for about, like, you know, 12 years or so. And interesting kick is they had recently announced a buyback offer to buy back about, like, 8% of the company. The buyback price was, like, let's say, so it's a tender offer, basically. They'll tell you what the tender purchase price is. And the market price could be much lower or much higher than that price at that time.
Okay.
So it was selling at, like, maybe 80 rupees per share, 80 or 90. The tender offer for at, like, 120 rupees. So I thought, like, you know what, I'm going to buy, like, a bunch of stock. I can tender it. No problems. Like, you'll get out in a couple of months. And there is a peculiar buyback rule in India. At least 20% of the buybacks that the company do, it has to be dedicated to the small investors who own, like, less than, like, $3,000 worth of stock.
Huh.
So if you owned less than $3,000 worth of stock, you can tender it. It's a guarantee that that's going to go through.
Interesting.
So I bought, like, a bunch of stock, like, in a less than, let's say, $3,000.
Yeah.
And my intention was to tender it and forget about it. And the tender was maybe, like, a month away. And then I started looking, like, in a little bit deeper because it's a software consulting company. I worked for a software consulting company before. And I looked at the customer concentration and then looked at, like, in a, looked at the, like, you know, who are the big fund manager who owned the company at that time. I talked to a couple of them. They were, like, you know, the Asian PE style companies, private equity companies.
Mm-hmm.
And I started looking, developing convincing case about this business. It was, like, really, really cheap. I mean, how many times you come across investment, like, 2x EBITDA to enterprise value and 3x in PE. And even if you don't even account for that, like, in, you know, cash.
Well, the enterprise value would account for the cash.
Yeah, in terms of PE, yeah.
Yeah.
It's like 3x. I thought, like, it's at least worth, like, 8 to 10x earnings.
Yeah.
It was not in any type of, like, a drastic measures. Indian software, they had about 5,000 employees at that time. They still do. They may still have, like, 6,000 employees today.
Were they growing when you looked at them?
They were not growing very fast. They were probably, like, you know, like, chugging along, like, in a few percent, like, in a 5 to 6% revenue growth and so on and so forth. And they didn't do anything with the cash, so they pretty much accumulated the cash at that point.
Yeah.
And I thought, like, maybe I can buy a little bit more and not do the tender.
Interesting.
So, yeah, I did not do the tender. And it was 2013 end that I bought. And they have done about 3 tenders since then, like higher and higher prices, because they had like lots of money coming in over the years.
Yep.
So let me give you an idea now. So the company is trading at 8 times PE now, price to earnings.
Okay.
And they have about 1/3 of their market cap is going to be in cash at the end of this year.
Interesting.
Yeah, that's probably my, in the recent years, probably the biggest return. Maybe I made about like 300% or so. It was one of the easiest choices I made good return.
Yeah. Isn't that funny that sometimes the ones you have to think the least about are the best returns?
I know. But it's difficult. I should have put 50% of my portfolio in that.
Yeah,
but
I know.
I'm just like too paranoid to do anything that concentrated.
I've had a few times where I wanted to put 40-50% into a stock and I wimped out.
Yeah, I've been on zero and the positive number. I never want to go back to zero. I don't know.
Exactly. You know what? I've never actually been wrong. Like every time I've wanted to do that, I would have always made a lot of money. But the one concern, right, is like over the course of several decades, the one time you're wrong and you screw yourself over and put yourself back 20 years. Like, you know, you don't want to ever be in that position.
Yeah, imagine losing 50% of the portfolio. And
I don't want to imagine that.
just idiotic. It doesn't matter what your IQ is.
Yeah, exactly. But I think it's interesting that, I have found that most people who become attracted to the investment world, especially in the value investing world, they're very analytical, right? Very smart people, very analytical. And I think sometimes people have a hard time just seeing the big picture. And I feel like I've come to it in an interesting way because I'm able to see the big picture first by nature, and then it takes me extra effort to be analytical about something. So I find that sometimes I'm in a conversation with someone about an investment, and they're telling you way too much stuff. It's like they're making these like fancy spreadsheets and charts, and it's like I don't need to know and understand all of this stuff. And it goes back to what you're saying. It's like you just explained the thesis in 30 seconds, or 15 seconds. And it's like, somewhat growing software business, easy to understand, no debt, 3 times EV to EBIT, right? Like kind of a no-brainer. You don't have to think about that at all. So it's always interesting how some people try to overanalyze what they're doing, and then there's stuff that just like takes a sentence to explain, and that often ends up being the best investments.
Believe me, I have done the other side also. I've gone through months and months of work through multiple things, and then I just figure out maybe I shouldn't do any of this, and it probably would have been better.
Yeah. Yeah, interesting. So I'm curious, what is the other story you wanted to share in terms of investment
that
workout for you?
That was Fiat Chrysler.
Okay.
Yeah, that was one of the fascinating plays. Pretty much it plays out, it's still playing out. Played out better than I would have ever anticipated in terms of business.
Yeah.
Maybe 2012 or 13. Europe went to hell at that point, and auto companies were in trouble. And I looked at I listened to Guy Spier, and he was talking in Bloomberg at that point. He usually doesn't do this interview.
Yep.
And he was talking about Fiat being cheap, and he talked very highly about Sergio Marchionne, and the CEO of the company.
And just for those who don't know who Guy Spier is, he runs a fund called Aquamarine Capital. Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, Guy is one of the very, very intelligent, savvy investors, and I should have given him
he's a great guy, just all around great guy.
Yeah, I should not have just put out Guy Spier. Yeah, I just listened to a bunch of people you and I talk, and we listen to each ideas, and then I looked at this. It was just so cheap on anything, but the one big problem is they owned close to 50% of the Chrysler, and you don't know how the UAW is going to think and work out selling or buying remaining shares. But it was just cheap. And they had a Ferrari. You know how it played out now.
Mm-hmm.
It's easy to see that now. in 2013, it wasn't that easy. So it was trading at maybe $5, 5 euros per share at that time, because it was not listed in Netherlands at that time. It was still a Italian company, and Chrysler wasn't consolidated on their results. And yeah, now right now they spun off the Ferrari to the shareholders. It's worth about $6 now. If you bought the company, it's $5, and you got the Ferrari alone, it's worth $6, and you still have pretty much everything other than Ferrari. For example, Chrysler makes about $1.5 billion in cash flow, after tax cash flow.
Yeah.
Yes, it's still playing out. I probably made about 250% return, and I still think the business is still very, very cheap relative to, let's say, what the next 3 years may bring.
So if you don't mind, for the people listening, can you go through why you think it's cheap in terms of the way that you think about valuing an asset like that?
Yeah, so there are three areas I would say about Fiat as being very key. The one is obviously the Chrysler and the SUVs, and even without the SUV, there is a brand called Jeep. Jeep was when Sergio bought the Chrysler, and he pretty much said he bought it for the Jeep brand, and I didn't understand at that time what the potential for Jeep at that point. Today, they are selling over 1 million units a year. When they bought it, it was selling less than 200,000 units a year. And this is a huge, huge underpenetrated market like China for brand like Jeep. So huge potential there. And then you have this hodgepodge of assets pretty much all the Latin American asset, all the European asset are pretty much thrown in there for free. And then they have a auto part supplier business that they're planning to sell over time, because that's one of the lower margin businesses. And Sergio Martino did a great job of running the business, and he is fanatic about return on invested capital, and which we all do as a value investors. Yeah. If you're investing in a business, it needs to make sense to invest in projects. It makes sense, right? And yeah, I guess it will probably make about $5 billion or so in a couple of years in terms of cash flow. The business is today selling for $17-18 billion. And at that time, probably the company couldn't have a net cash position instead of a net debt position today.
Interesting.
So if you say $5 billion after tax cash flow, and the company is today selling for, let's say, three times cash flow.
Yeah. Fascinating stuff. And I assume you're familiar with Monish Pabrai too.
Yeah, yeah. Actually, I met Guy Spier and Monish Pabrai multiple times in Berkshire Hathaway annual meetings and so on and so forth.
Very cool. Well, when are you going to the Berkshire meeting this year?
I'm still planning, yes.
Cool.
I haven't booked or anything, but yeah.
All right, well, when the show's over, let's exchange, let's coordinate. I'd love to meet you when I'm out there as well this year.
Yeah, absolutely.
Very cool. So currently, where have you been finding the most value? Has it been in India right now, or?
Well, other than the one particular investment that I talked about in India, there are a few pockets in India in terms of, as you said, seeing the bigger picture,
right,
rather than wasting your time on miniatures. And there are some industries I think I'm still doing work on that. They're poised to grow very, very high rates every over the years.
Yeah.
One of the industry that I can think of is data consumption. In terms of broadband, it could be wireless networks and tower business and so on and so forth. I think that looks very interesting in India, especially because a lot of rich private equity businesses in US and Europe, they want to get participated in those kind of markets. But it remains to be seen who's going to be the winner in that space. But I'm very keen on learning that. But specific in terms of opportunities, there are still, again, the things that I own are probably cheaper than anything else that I find. Otherwise, I wouldn't be owning them right. to begin with. And but there are some, like, you know, even in U.S. or in Europe, there are a bunch of areas, like sectors, undervalued because they're going through, like, a transformation or the future doesn't look that great, maybe a little bit bleak. Mm-hmm. Like, take a look at, like, an industry like refiners here today in U.S.
Yeah.
The refining margins are, like, down like crazy and yeah, like, you know, let's see how that plays out. I have, like, a few investments in refiners. But to give you an idea on, like, in refiners, in the last 30 years, no new refinery license has been issued in U.S.
Yeah, it's amazing.
And the production or, say, like, productivity, volumes in these refineries hasn't been that great either. In 30 years, they've compounded at, like, maybe, like, 1 or 2% a year in terms of processing capacity.
Yeah, interesting. So you said you own some refiners?
Yeah, I do own some refiners. It's like a basket bet because, as you always know, that you don't know what you don't know.
Right.
With a capital asset intensive business and low margin business, and I bought this as a group to see that, like, you know, the better days are ahead, multiples are cheaper today, and they would probably consolidate at some point. And yeah, they're not losing any money yet. In terms of cash flows,
yeah. Do you typically have a pretty concentrated portfolio, or is it more diversified? Where do you land on that spectrum?
Yeah, it depends on how you define a concentration. Like, and if you say, like, would I put, like, you know, four companies in my whole portfolio? The answer is no.
Okay.
So I'm not that concentrated. I'm probably, like, you know, in the value investor's mentality, I'm probably very well diversified.
Go ahead.
Sorry, yeah. I think you're going for how many positions that I hold usually.
Yeah.
Yeah. I probably hold about, like, 20 to 30 situations.
Okay.
But I would say the first 10 positions, maybe they'd be composed of, like, 60% of my portfolio.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah. So, and then in terms of baskets, would you, if you consider a basket of stocks just one position, let's say, is it still around 20 to 30?
The basket probably around like less than 10.
Okay.
So the basket as a group. Yeah, the group as, like, let's say refiners, right?
We're talking right. about. So say little refiners probably, is one.
Yeah.
So you'd own less than 10 positions if you include the basket as one?
Well, in this particular case, like, I only own one basket, or actually two basket, maybe I can count that big bank warrants, like, as a one position, as a, like, in a bunch of banks, like, in a TARP warrant that I own.
Okay.
So those two positions probably around, like, 20% of my portfolio.
Mm-hmm.
And underneath, there may be, like, you know, like 8 or 10 securities there.
Okay.
So if you look at one security, that's probably, like, you know, 1 or 2%.
Got it. So you would say then, so if you say those are two positions, then the rest is maybe like 10 more positions, about?
That's something like that.
Yeah. Okay, interesting. So you're relatively concentrated, I would say.
Okay.
Yeah. You're not, you know.
Because, like, you know, when concentration comes to my mind, people always talk about, oh, I'm going to put, like, you know, 20% of my position in one particular company, and that's what scares me.
Okay. Yeah,
because it's just the way I'm wired, I think, because I feel that I don't know what I don't know.
Well, it goes back to the whole idea of circle of competence, right? So
right.
Interesting. And then how's so tell me a little bit about how your company is structured and how's that
yeah,
going?
Yeah, it's an investment advisory business. It's registered in Washington, D.C.
Okay.
It manages portfolios for clients, individuals, and a little bit few institutions in separately managed account. So basically, like, let's say Eric, you want to be my client, and Eric would open up an account with, like, let's say my custodian. Mm-hmm. And it's your account, it's your money. All you do is, like, you know, you provide me the discretionary authority to place your cash into investments.
Right.
And yeah, like, you know, we agree on the fee structure, and it's your account. You can monitor anytime you want. And you will hear from me at least, like, four times a year with detailed report on what I think on investments, what we hold, and sometimes I write about like in a couple of investments that are in position right now. And like, yeah, you can reach out to me anytime you want in terms of your portfolio, but it's still your account, your portfolio, and it's not consolidated under, you know, one umbrella or anything like that.
So when you're buying for multiple accounts, are the allocation, you know, sizes the same? Like, let's say, for instance, I was coming in as a new investor today. Are you going to allocate it exactly the same as everyone else? Or, you know, how do you manage that?
It's actually different, different for different people, because depends on what time they come on board. The opportunity set may be completely different.
Right.
And I'm not like, you know, willing to buy and sell all the time, because that's not really a great way to get rich.
Yeah.
So let's say, like, you know, a client came on like last year when I set up the company, relative to, let's say, you come on tomorrow as a new client, the opportunity set is completely different. So the position size may be different. The position size also may be different.
Okay.
And, you know, that's what I think. I know it's not a very efficient way of managing.
Oh, no, I don't know if it's inefficient. I'm just wondering, because everyone has a different style in doing that. So let's say I come on today, is it possible I will own securities that other people don't own?
Or is possible? Yeah, okay. Very much possible. Yeah. Because, like, you know, some of the clients are like, money's like, you know, completely invested until they bring me more money, or, you know, if you don't like some of the securities that they own, they may switch that.
Mm-hmm.
Other than that, if we like what we own for that client and they have like, you know, prosper future and the securities are priced low relative to what I think they are worth.
Yeah.
And yeah, they stay put.
And then when you're writing your letters, because say different accounts might have some different securities, how do you consolidate that essentially in when you write to your investors?
Yeah, I write like two different letters, like in terms of like in performance, of course, and in terms of portfolio, the positions are like almost same. Let's say, like, you know, among the 30 different securities that we own collectively, each one they overlap, right? Not everybody owns that 30.
Yep.
But I'll probably talk about like in a few in the letters, and you know, I talked about like, you know, at least couple per letter. So in the year, I probably talked about 8 different investments, and yeah, they get their return, you know, returns as per their account.
Okay.
So it's pretty much like I'm catering to that particular client. So if Eric comes on board, I'm gonna tell you like, Eric, what you own, how much you own, how I think about these positions. That said, you're like a niche client to me.
Oh, so you essentially have custom letters for your different clients, essentially.
Yeah, yeah.
Very cool. Very cool. And then when you report returns, you're reporting the returns per that client.
If the letters for that particular client, yeah. Yes. It makes sense to tell them about their performance rather than the consolidated performance.
It makes sense. And then if I was to come on as a new investor and I was like, tell me about your track record, would you then show me your consolidated performance? Is that how you
would? Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Because I actually, if you look at my website, we'll share the information at the end of the show as you described. And that's basically the consolidated report.
Okay.
So that's like a marketing material, right? Like to the world to know that, like, you know, how I've done. It's a report card for me as a manager. How I have done consolidated through all my accounts. And that is a consolidated performance metrics. And mm-hmm. If you are a client, you would receive from me your particular performance.
Very cool. So you're not actually going to send them so I'm on your website right now, on the GB Investments website. So I see the different reports for 2016. If I'm an investor, that's not what I'm receiving. I'm receiving my own essentially custom letter. And this is for sort of the world to see.
Yeah, it's a consolidated report, that one. If your prospective clients would receive that. As a client, already existing client, they would receive their own account and set of thinking behind that.
You know, I think you're on to something. How are you going to do this, though? If you, say one day if you have 100 clients, how are you going to consolidate that?
Well, we'll figure that out at some point, right?
Yeah, that'd be a good problem to have, right?
Yeah. At the point, like, you know, we'll figure something out. I can think a few things, but yeah, it remains to be seen whether we will get to that level, or maybe new opportunities will come up at that point.
Yeah. Well, awesome. Is there anything else that you might want to talk about or like to share or anything you think I haven't covered? So we've covered quite a bit.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, pretty much like a typical value investor looking for opportunities across the world, you know. We talked about US and India as a destination for investments. Yeah, I probably have investment like 8 different countries.
Yeah, I wouldn't say you're a typical value investor though, because you definitely do have, at least it seems to me, you know, when talking about India and some of the more international stuff that you look at, you have more of a niche there and you spend more time there. Not all of us do.
Okay. But that's something that I think I understand. But, you probably understand something about like a New Hampshire better than me, right?
Possibly.
Yeah. Yeah, since I've never been to New Hampshire. So I pretty much hope that you know more than me.
Yeah. With individual securities, I wouldn't say so, though. In terms of New Hampshire-based companies, I'm not sure how much an advantage I have just from living in New Hampshire personally.
Interesting.
Yeah. I think some of that, not all of it, but I think in my experience, some of that is overrated. It's almost like a false confidence. Like, well, I live close, so now I understand it better. It's like, well, do you understand it better, or is it, do you just feel better about it and there's a false confidence there? I don't have the answer, but
that's right. That's exactly the first thing that we talked about, right?
Since
I'm from India, do I feel like I have some advantage? It's a gray area.
I think when you talked about that software company, right, there was an advantage there because your background is in software, your background in India, the guy, you have a friend who can tell you about it and you can take a look at. You know, most people wouldn't have come across that, I don't think.
Okay, you're right.
Yeah. So I think you should own that personally. But awesome. And then your website is gbinvestmentsllc.com, right?
That's correct, yeah. And it's registered in Washington, D.C.,
okay.
Regulated by the Washington, D.C. regulators.
Okay.
And, yeah, I manage a little more than a couple of millions now. And if that's very important or anything to your listeners, and hopefully, yeah, your listeners had a good time listening to us, whatever we had to talk about.
Yeah. And if anyone wants to contact you, what's the best way for people to reach out to you if they want to?
The best way is basically you can go to the website and you have all my information there basically about
the
email, phone, and you can even contact through my website. So that's probably the best way. The website is gbinvestmentsllc.com.
Okay, great. Well, Gobi, it was great having you on the show. And thanks for your time today.
Thank you so much, Eric. It was always a pleasure to talk about anything, in this case, investments. So yeah, I really had a great time. I hope your listeners will also have a little bit better time than us, I think.
Yes.
So they'll get the benefit.
Exactly. All right, well, great having you on the show, and have a great day.
Thank you. You too.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Intelligent Investing Podcast with Eric Schlein. If you'd like to connect with Eric for questions, comments, feedback, ideas, or to inquire about being on the show, please contact Eric at intelligentinvesting@gmail.com. So, in the words of Charlie Munger, I have nothing to add.